The force for world missions is growing around the world. To the number of third world missionaries need to be added the growing number of tent makers and short-term workers. The term tent makers attracts our attention because we wonder, what's a tent maker? What's tent making got to do with missions? The origin of the term comes from Acts 18, 1 through 5. After this, Paul left Athens and he went to Corinth. And there he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. And when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. And then over in 1 Corinthians 9:6, we read Paul's words, "Or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living?" In other words, Paul was sometimes a donor-supported missionary and sometimes a self-supporting missionary. And when he was a self-supporting missionary, he supported himself by making tents. That was his trade. And so we often refer to self-supporting missionaries as tent makers. Peter Wagner gives us a more formal definition. Christians who go out to other cultures today, but who support themselves rather than expecting to receive support from a church or mission agency, are known as tent makers. Not all are short-termers. Some make it a career. And so we need to distinguish then between missionaries who are self-supporting, and we call them in popular terminology tent makers, and missionaries who are donor-supported. Sometimes it's not a matter of either or. Sometimes people can be partially supported by donors and partially self-supporting, and the percentages may vary greatly. I think, for example, of a friend of mine who went to a Central American nation as a medical doctor. In order to establish his practice there, there were a lot of government regulations which he had to meet, which took time before he could actually be earning substantial enough to support himself. And so he received a partial support from ascending church for a while until his medical practice began to allow him to support himself and his family. Sometimes persons are able to support themselves entirely by their work within a given nation, sometimes through investments. I have one friend, for instance, who through his investments throughout the world has been able to devote all of his time to missionary service, simply giving the control of his financial empire over to a steward. Well, there are different types of tent makers. Just as we said, there's a difference between donor-supported and self-supporting missionaries. Among self-supporting missionaries, there's probably two types. One is a Pauline type. They go with the primary motivation of making the gospel known, and they do whatever's necessary to survive. That was Paul. His purpose was to make the gospel known. And he went where he went because he was gospel driven, and then he earned his living as he had to. The other type would be the Priscilla and Aquila type. They were tent makers by profession. They weren't found in the cities of the empire because they chose to go there. It was just that the emperor Claudius kicked them out of Rome because they were Jews. And they went where they had to go in order to survive. And there, because they were active Christians, they got busy witnessing to the gospel and establishing the church. So this type, this Priscilla and Aquila type, enter another country because of a work assignment. And then as they're able, they share the gospel with others. What are some of the sending mechanisms that are open to self-supporting missionaries today? Well, of course, there's the Peace Corps. There's embassy work. There's work with international organizations. There's work with multinational corporations. There's work with the government. There's work for business people. In fact, one of the great challenges is to go into a nation in order to start a business. Every nation is looking for investment in order to help their economic climate, and they're exceedingly open to Christians who will go into their country to start new businesses and employ their people and to raise their standard of living. And that kind of situation gives the person who starts the business a great deal of control over their free time and is an ideal way, in many senses, to being a tent maker. Or you can go as a student. That's still another way. Enter the university, become a perpetual student, and use your free time to plant the church and share the gospel. One of the most preferred kinds of tent-making ministries or self-supporting ministries today is that of the English teacher, person who teaches English as a second language or teaches English as a foreign language. English is becoming the worldwide trade language, and there's a great demand for English teachers, and often they are able to gain access to many parts of the world to which full-time vocational missionaries who are supported by donors cannot enter. And they can influence students. Often they're able to have contact with among the most influential people in that part of the world. Now, there are a number of advantages and limitations to being a tent maker or being a self-supporting missionary. And we need to see that being a self-supporting missionary and being a donor-supported missionary are really complementary. I think Ruth Siemens puts this rather well when she says, God's agents, mission agencies are God's regular army, but we need guerrilla forces that can enter closed countries and infiltrate every structure of society. So she sees self-supporting missionaries as God's guerrilla forces who complement the regular army of fully supported or donor-supported missionaries in the task of world evangelization. Tent makers do have some advantages. They have access to nations which are restricted access nations we used to call closed countries. They're able to get in because their services are desired. And I've been able to clip out of the newspaper locally and here right in the state advertisements run by nations, national governments, which we would consider restricted access or closed countries, advertising for North Americans to come and work in their country in a variety of jobs. So it provides access to closed countries. It also provides regular contact with the elite. If you're going to be going with an embassy or with a multinational corporation or with an international organization, chances are that you're going to be interacting with the highest levels of society, people who may be Western-oriented and very literate and very much aware of your own country. And to influence them may influence the direction of the entire country. So it can be very strategic to be a tent maker. And then tent makers often provide special encouragement for the people with whom they work. Now, they're working side by side, day by day, with national Christians or national unbelievers. And this can be a great encouragement to the believers who are there as they see how Christians function in the workplace. And many contacts and trust relationships can be developed. However, there are some limitations too. And we must not pass over the limitations as though they did not exist. We need to take account of limitations. One of those is the limitation of being an employee. That is, you enter a country as the employee of a large company or a school, and they might decide to move you at any time. And that means that your work can be interrupted. And your ideal of being in a given place for enough time to establish a group of Christians may just be interrupted because you're transferred to someplace else. You're there at the discretion of your employer. And then there's the whole matter of identification. Sometimes that can be greatly frustrating. You can become isolated for security reasons. It could be that because you are known to be from a Christian country that you are limited in the contacts, the social contacts that you can have with people. It may be that for security reasons, maybe you're working with sensitive material, that you're isolated. And here you are in this part of the world where you want to be, where there are very few Christians, and yet you're restricted and lonely. Loneliness is another factor that can be a limitation because you don't have contact with a lot of other Christian people. Lack of accountability can be a problem. For your Christian life, you're not accountable to anyone unless you are linked up in some sort of a quiet way with the a mission agency or a fellowship of group of Christians or a local church. And then there's the ethical tension that must be faced. People want to know, well, why? What are you doing here in this country? Why are you digging wells out in the middle of the desert? Other foreigners haven't come here. And perhaps there's no difficulty at all with saying, well, I'm a Christian and I'm here because I really want to live out Christ's, the life which Christ has called me to. Maybe you can do that, but maybe it would be very dangerous to do that. And so you're living with ethical tension. Why are you there? What are your real reasons? What about the applications that you have to fill out? And this can have some real disadvantages. It can make it very difficult. Sometimes your aspirations aren't realized. I had a missionary colleague during my first term of service in a Central American nation who felt that he could make a greater contribution to the cause of Christ working with the government service. Because as a missionary, he established relationships with the community, the international community, the ambassadors and the consulates and things like that. And he had a tremendous ministry among those people. He said, well, if I was a part of that, think how my ministry would be multiplied. And so he wrote a letter to the President of the United States offering his services. And believe it or not, he got an answer within a week. He was thinking of finishing his term of missionary service, but they said, we want you in Miami right now. And so he came up there, and rather than getting classified, not only was he accepted, but instead of being classified 8 out of 8, you got a series of classifications, maybe they've changed by now, he was classified a 5. And they said, well, here's a person, he knows the Spanish language, he also knows Greek and Hebrew, and he's acquainted with Bible lands. He expected he'd be sent to Latin America because that's where his love was. And instead he got sent to Israel, because how many people in the Foreign Service know the Bible and can read Hebrew? And he arrived a week before the Six-Day War broke out. Well, he spent a couple of years there, and then he said, well, my term of service is up, but they're going to send me back to Latin America. I've put that down as my choice. They said, oh, he's got a Dutch wife. We'll send him to Suriname. So they sent him to Suriname, gave him a great position. And as he continued in the Foreign Service, he discovered that the ministry that he had as a missionary to the Foreign Service community had dried up, because since he was part of the community, everybody thought maybe he's a spy. Better not tell him anything intimate. I really gotta watch myself here. And so this tremendous personal ministry that he had as a missionary kind of dried up. And when they assigned him for his third term to Washington, D.C., so that he'd never gotten to Latin America, which is where he felt the Lord had called him, he resigned from the Foreign Service, took a pastorate along the border with Mexico, where he's able to work with Mexican immigrants as well as pastor a church in that part of the world. So there are some limitations. However, there are some advantages, and we need to underscore those advantages. And so we have asked the general director of OMF to tell us how he views tent making as a strategy for evangelism.
I think one of the significant developments for mission in the next decade is going to be in the area of professional service. Now, the term that's been used has been tent making. We in OMF are not positive to that term because it's a loaded term. It's loaded in two ways. One is that Paul's use of tent making, that doesn't fit what we're talking about. Now, the second reason is that tent making is known by the governments and religious authorities of people we would like to reach as a way of inserting covert missionaries. Therefore, it's a term that has bad connotations. Third reason why we would like to use the term professional service is that both exalts the professional excellence that is needed and the spirit in which that is to be done, that is in spirit of service. But it has to be by those who have a commitment to the Great Commission. That is to win men and women to Jesus Christ. And one of the modes in which we can do that, as well as traditional missionary work, is through Christian professional service. Because there are places and people that a missionary cannot enter That is an unacceptable label to government or to religious authorities or to the people you want to reach. It's an insensitive and an unacceptable term. But professionals can. There is no country in the world, to my knowledge, that does not receive foreigners. And therefore, those with a professional, marketable skill will be welcome. And for some, as Christians, they can reach people, penetrate countries for Jesus Christ in exercising a professional skill. Now, I see this as a significant development for the evangelization of the world, and in OMF, in fulfilling our goal of the urgent evangelization of East Asia's millions, we will be able to place, as we are now, those who are Christians with a professional skill that a country needs in the economic catch-up that's taking place in our world. And as Christians, they can bear testimony to Christ. It's a little bit like an accordion. Sometimes your witness can be quite wide. Sometimes it's very narrow. You may be very confined with what you can say. That will depend upon religious or political circumstances and sensitivities. But nonetheless, just as a Christian, you will have opportunities to witness to Christ. And as a professional, you will be able to model what it is to be a Christian professional in Asia.
David Picard has certainly given us an outstanding summary of the significance of tent making or self-supporting mission service, or as he likes the term, professional service. And I think that that's an excellent term. There are increasing number of resources for people who seek to serve God in this way. In fact, at last count, there are 73 mission agencies who are interested and involved in placing people in self-supporting missionary roles. And many other resources are available. Organizations have sprung into being. There's an organization called Tent Makers International, another called Global Opportunities, another called TMQ Research. And the Midwest Center of World Missions has devoted itself principally to the training and giving information, counseling of those people who are considering this kind of missionary service in order to add to the global missionary force. We want to turn our attention now to short-term missionaries or short-term service. This is an increasing number, and by short-term service, I mean people who serve under 2 years. Most of them serve for about 18 months, some for much shorter periods of time. And the number of persons who do not see themselves as career missionaries, but rather as involved in short-term service, is increasing dramatically in North America. The best statistics we have indicate that in 1965, there were 540 short-term missionaries. By 1976, the number was up to 6,000. By 1979, just 3 years later, it was up to 17,000. By 1986, to 27,933, and the 1988 statistics, the most recent which I have, are 30,748. The number of short-term missionaries is increasing much more rapidly than the number of career missionaries, although that number is also increasing. Well, what are the sources? Where do these short-term missionaries come from? Well, there are skilled workers, people who have particular skills that can be used in missionary service. I think of people like agricultural workers who can provide very specialized service in areas of drought, in areas where community development is a very prominent part of missionary service. I think of people who are accountants and can come and do audits on mission books. I remember one person who was a certified public accountant who devoted time each year or every other year in tandem with someone else to come and prepare tax returns for missionaries to free them from that responsibility. Medical doctors who can come to offer specialized medical help. I remember an eye surgeon who came to work with us and went into the charity hospital and began to perform cataract operations for people who could not afford operations. And the medical community was astounded because their attitude is, let's avoid charity work. It doesn't pay. They weren't Christians. They couldn't see any sense in helping anybody who couldn't pay. And the fact that he, who was a renowned surgeon, would take time off and at no pay, even paying his own expenses, would come down and spend a month or 6 weeks out of every year working among the poorest of the poor to perform cataract operations, had a powerful effect on the attitude of the medical profession. Opened them up to the gospel and resulted in, maybe out of shame, beginning a charity clinic for eye care in that part of the world. So it can be this short-term service can be significant. Interns, my own son-in-law, needed to do his intern in order to complete his Master of Divinity degree, and decided right after seminary to serve a two-year term as a short-term service for 2 years in the Philippines in order to fulfill his requirements as well as enter immediately into missionary service so that he could use all that he had learned during his Master of Divinity program immediately rather than waiting a long time and raising a higher support level in order to go as a career person. All kinds of summers, people on summer vacations, during summers, students who are on break, giving weeks or months of their vacation to evangelization. And then think of retired people. People retiring younger and younger with a high level of skills and still young enough to be able to learn a language and adapt to a culture or do support work, which can free missionaries to do other work for which they are better suited. Ran across a case just the other day of a couple who retired at the age of 65, went to a country in Africa for 9 years. The wife died. The husband went back, and he finally retired at the age of 84 from missionary service. So these are the sources: skilled workers, interns, summers, summer vacation, people on summer vacation, and retired people. There may be other. But what are some of the values of a short-term work? Well, it can provide relief for missionaries. Many times they are involved in a work that is very time-consuming and absorbs a lot of their time, but is not productive in terms of their ultimate goals. I remember a short-term worker who came and served as a librarian. I was in charge of a theological school and was also trying to work in the library, and she was able to classify books and help us enormously during a given summer. Another thing that it does is it provides opportunity to test skills. People wonder, do I have a missionary gift? Am I able to relate to people in other cultures? Am I flexible? Am I able to communicate my love for other people? How does it come across in another culture? And so people are able to test their gifts in this way. Another advantage or value is that a high percentage of short-termers return and become career workers. In fact, the best studies that I have indicates that one out of every four short-termers will return to missionary service as a career missionary. On the other hand, the statistics are even more encouraging because of people who are currently becoming career missionaries. 90% of them have had some kind of short-term service. So we can see that of all short-termers, one in four will become a career person, and of all the career people, 90% have had some kind of short-term service or experience. So it can be a tremendous investment to support short-term missions, a tremendous investment on the part of a local church. And think of the excitement that it brings to a local church. People who have never had experience, they come back, they want to serve on the missions committee, they're able to share and give a firsthand sense of excitement to what God is doing around the world, and they can lift the spiritual temperature of the whole church by just a few weeks that they have spent in another culture engaged in missionary service. And then they gain perspective for their life and their values. They're in a situation oftentimes of poverty. They learn about differences. They overcome their parochialism. They understand more clearly the mission of the church. And it's a life investment for the person. Sometimes what happens to them is even more important than what they do during the time they're on the field. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some limitations. There are limitations to short-term service. One is the lack of experience. Sometimes people come with just lack of experience, and they're not able to do anything very significant. Or they may lack the training to do the kind of job that needs to be done in the area of the world to which they're going. The fact that they don't know the language, although most of the time short-termers are sent to areas where they can minister in their own language insofar as possible, sometimes that's not true. And then it becomes a very frustrating experience because of not knowing the language. We have to think, too, of travel cost. Is it worthwhile to spend $2,000 or $3,000 to send someone for a summer for just 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 5 weeks? Could not that money be better invested in other areas of the Lord's service? So the economics figures in, and we really need to measure that and to weigh that. And then, too, there's the matter of work that lacks continuity. If you depend on short-term people to come for a year, 2 years at a time, think of what that does to missionary children's school, where there's a great turnover in personnel. And missionary children are away from their parents, and they're looking for stability, and there just aren't a lot of career people teaching in missionary children's school, and there's a tremendous turnover. Or other kinds of ministries that demand stability. Youth ministry, that here's a youth person comes, and he's there a year and gone. The significance of stability and the value of long-term relationships is important, and short-term service doesn't always provide that. Nevertheless, as we look at what God is doing around the world, there's no doubt that He is raising up a significant missionary force. That missionary force is increasing through third world missionaries and through the flexibility that we have through professional service or tent makers or self-supporting missionaries and through short-term missions. And we need to thank God for the growth that we are seeing in many, many ways in the missionary force around the world.